Okay, I think maybe we'll get started. Very good. So, talked a lot about meditation and how to get the mind peaceful, how to get these beautiful lights coming up in the mind, and sort of what happens next. But in meditation in today's world, people always ask about the insight part of the meditation. And so today I'm going to be talking a little bit about the connection between the meditation I'm teaching here and the arising of insight. And it was the case that so-called insight meditation has become almost like a practice in itself. And first of all, to understand where that came from, it was always in Buddhism. We've never actually distinguished between just the meditation as this is an insight meditation or this is a calm meditation. Those two paths have always been connected. It's not either one or the other. And whenever anybody says, oh, this path is a fast path, then that always tells me that there's some conceit there, some measuring. And people think, oh, this is the elite. The origin of the modern Vipassana movement, and out of that came the mindfulness movement, the origin came from a monk called Lady Sayadaw in Burma a couple of centuries ago. And it's interesting, in brief, this is just like history. In brief, what had happened, that Lady Sayadaw, they're named after the place in which, the monastery in which they're the abbot. So if I was in that tradition, then I'd be called Bodhinyana Sayadaw, because that's where your monastery is. And Ihasapanya would be called Dhammasara Sayali. So it's just not a personal name, but the name of the place where you come from. So Lady Sayadaw, L-E-D-I, was a very good teacher, but got a bit spooked when my ancestors, the British, sort of extended their control over Burma by taking control over Mandalay, and thought that that was going to be the end of the true Dhamma over in Burma. And so that he wanted to make Buddhism in Burma more popular, and to make it more popular, to make meditation more accessible, and to emphasize the insight practice instead of the jhana practice. And he did that with lots of other very good work to try and extend the reach of Buddhism, you know, to more and more people. Because it is true that, you know, for getting into a jhana, it takes much more skill, much more time, much more commitment to do the peaceful meditations. But over many years, over many teachers, that became like a path in itself, almost divorced of its origins. Because that tradition never came into Thailand that much, teachers like Ajahn Chah, when asked about, now, Vipassana and Samatha, the insight and the calm meditations, you know, what's the difference? And because, you know, he was a product of so many centuries of forest monks over in Thailand, that, you know, sometimes he would just, again, use simple techniques, simple visual aids. He'd just hold up his hand again. You see, now you can see the front of my hand, but the back of my hand is there as well, but you just can't see it because it's just falling right behind. That's the back of my hand, but then the front of my hand is also just right behind. You can't split one from the other. Where there's a front, there's a back. So where there's a calm, there's the insight. Where there's the insight, there's a calm. And hopefully some of you have understood that for the few days you're here. As the mind gets peaceful, as you calm down, almost you might say the addiction to the past and the future, the indulgence in thinking, As we calm that down and that settles down, and as your mind gets energized and clear, you can tend to see things much more clearly. Just like the windscreen of the car, it gets a wash so you can see things. And when that happens, the five hindrances have been suppressed. Then not only that what you see is much more engaging, it's much more delightful, but it's also you can understand exactly where these things all fit. You imagine just going walking through the bush at night time without a flashlight. You're going to bump into many trees, you're going to trip over the rocks, you're going to hurt yourself because your awareness is not strong. Now that awareness, that brightness of the mind is symbolized here that when you do have a very powerful mind, you know, whatever you look at, it's like with a flashlight, you can see it really clearly, so you don't tend to trip up on things. And that opens up such a big area of understanding, which is not just for your spiritual life and the understanding of the nature of things. When a mind gets empowered, you can use it for all sorts of things in your daily life, in your work life, in everywhere, in health, medicine, psychology. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why there's a huge number of psychologists. They get all of their teachings, you know, from Buddhism and from people like myself, and I don't know how this always happens, but every now and again somebody comes across one of my stories and it's there on the internet, taught by some psychologist who's making a fortune out of this. I suppose, you know, you say there's no, we don't have any copyright in these teachings, but nevertheless a little acknowledgement might be nice somewhere. You know that teaching which, you know, I invented, how heavy is the cup? I've done this one here, haven't I? How heavy is the cup? Yeah. How heavy is the cup? The longer you hold it, the heavier it feels. So I was going to some ceremony somewhere, and a local MP was asked to give a talk. It was a Thai ceremony. And the local MP came up on the stage. It's the MP for Perth. And she said, a wise man once said that if you hold up a cup for too long, and there I was in the audience laughing my head off, or one of I think she's the head of the occupational therapy department for the people in Singapore, in the Center for Mental Health and Wellbeing. And she said, so she showed on a conference a presentation of some of the latest psychology techniques, and this was from a therapist over in Sydney. And his major technique was the problem with people, they hold their hand too close to their eyes. They can only put it out here, and then the hand would not diminish in size, but they get perspective. All the problems in life, the loss of a loved one, now a cancer, and sort of sacked from work, it's always because you hold your hand too close to your eyes. You put it out here where it belongs. It doesn't diminish the size of the hand, but it puts it in perspective so you don't get so obsessed. So all these little sort of techniques that sometimes you see them going out there in the world. And actually it's, frankly, I think it's wonderful that, you know, some of these ideas really help. So these are little insights which sometimes you can take for granted, which come up in your meditation. Things like, again, the monster in the emperor's palace. Or sort of one of the other ones, not just the monster in the emperor's palace, but the opening the door of your heart. And this is one of those, please excuse me for repeating some of these stories, but sometimes these stories, which, you know, many of you know probably better than I do, they slot in at appropriate places in talks. And that is the one about a group over here in Perth. I'm sure they have branches all over Australia, called the Australian Society of Survivors of Torture and Trauma. So these are people, who have come as asylum seekers, refugees to Australia. And they really have been through some unimaginable pain, torture, rape, abuse, sometimes for months or years. And they've managed to seek asylum in Australia, been granted it. But physically they have their freedom, but emotionally they're still in those torture chambers being beaten and raped, boys and girls. And sometimes when you hear some of the stories, you can't get your head around it. That's the word we use. How one human being can do such gross cruelty and abuse to another. As a monk, who maybe I lived a very fortunate life with my parents, my father, I said last night, had been abused as a kid, but he never visited abuse on anybody. He learned by the extreme pain of being beaten for no reason and being impotent when the person he loved the most, his mother, my grandma, was also abused and he couldn't help her. You can understand that hurt much more than being on the end of a whipping himself, seeing someone he loved and he couldn't protect her. But anyway, there's way, way worse things than this go on in the world, believe it or not. And so this little group was trying to do something to emotionally to free them from the pain of their past. As many of you sometimes ask, how can I let go of the past? You're writing it on toilet paper, you know, that's not bad if it's ordinary abuse, but the gross type of abuse is incredibly difficult. But some of the things which, you know, you teach, you get insight into, they open up this huge array of possibilities. That's what insight does. It sees things in a totally different way. And from there, you have the pathway to greater innovation, to find out other ways of dealing with these problems, very successful ways. And the way which I'm talking about now is to open the door of your heart. And I was surprised. I never realized that someone would take that and apply it in such an extremely difficult emotional problem of dealing with the trauma, huge trauma of excessive abuse. But a few of the people, the psychologists, they told me they'd got their permission to practice from going to university and getting the degrees. They said everything useful, the stuff which they used every day in their practice, they learned at Dhammaloka City Centre, listening to the monks and the nuns teach. And one of the ones which really worked was the opening the door of your heart. And of course, you know, just to give you the background story, if those of you don't know this, I was about 13 or 14. My father, who was legitimately poor, sometimes people say they came from poverty as a badge of honour. It's almost like, you know, that you had to work even harder, that you weren't entitled, you weren't born with a silver spoon in your mouth. I don't think I was even born with a plastic spoon in my mouth. It was just a broken old, whatever they could find in my mouth. Second-hand used, probably. But I was legitimately poor, mostly because my father was ill. He suffered from asthma for most of his life and so had difficulty keeping a job because of his physical ailments. So anyway, but he was a wonderful father. And when I was about 13 or 14, in a second-hand beat-up old car, He picked me up from school and stopped on a street just in Acton, poor part of Acton. And I know it was poor because all my friends, they were all migrants, you know, Africans, Polish, and from. I never realised that if you go to a school with mostly migrants, that's usually the poorer areas. But anyway, he said to me as he pulled up, he just parked specifically just to tell me something which was on his mind. And it was that, son, however you turn out in your life, whatever you do, whatever you become, I want you to always remember the door of my house will always be open to you. I'll never be that ashamed of you or embarrassed or angry at you, and I'll shut you out of my house. Now, when you're only 13 or 14, you don't really understand the importance of something like that, only that somehow or other it had a meaning which later on I would actually really get into and understand and take further. It was only just one of the fortunate things about being a monk, you know, especially those early years in Thailand when you had no responsibility at all, or at least not much. You had all these opportunities and time to really reflect on some experiences which you knew were important, but you didn't know why. Now, one of our problems these days is we don't have such time. We're always doing something. It's one of the reasons why when you come here, please don't try and attain jhanas. It's another task which stops you enjoying this moment, understanding it, and actually reaching those jhana states. We just get ourselves so busy. If it's not with work, with writing our biography or our next book, or just sorting out problems, instead of just stop and allow the world to teach you. It is very much like, you know, that the world has always got these lessons teaching you, but people are always on their mobile phones, so they can't listen. That's just a metaphor. We're always doing something, so we don't actually listen to life as it's constantly encouraging us and teaching us. So anyway, when I had that opportunity, that experience, that memory came up as something important that I had to deal with. And I didn't know why. And of course, the solution was, you know, wonderful, because it wasn't my father's house. His house was, as many people know, was a council flat. Number 17 Edendale, if anybody wishes to know, built by the local government council for poor people to give them housing after the Second World War. It was just a council flat. Not a house, it was just a little flat. It was a poor part of the world. And it was small. And one of the memories which I do have, I was sharing some of these memories with my brother when I saw him, and some of the things he remembers and I don't remember, because different things may not have been in the room at the time. But I do remember just my father put like a £1 note, just a £1 note currency, on this shelf above the open fire. It was coal fire, because that's all you could afford. That's what caused the London smog in those days. And all the windows were closed, you know, to try and keep the warmth coming up, but somewhere or other, a gust, a breeze sort of came, and the £1 note, which should have still been on that shelf, just, you know, was caught in the gust and just fell into the open coal fire. And it started burning, and my father was desperate enough to actually to try and put his hand in that fire to rescue the pound note. He burnt his hand, and my mother just burst out crying, weeping. Just no £1 note had just gone like that. Just the way it had you know, vanished and burnt. One minute it was there, the next minute it was just all cinders, and my poor father was in pain. So that was, you know, was legitimate poverty, but you never realise as a kid, you just enjoy it, really, because that's just what you know and it's what everybody together. But when he said the door of my house is always open to you, I realised it was not his house. That was nothing to open to anybody, frankly. But what he really meant, the meaning behind that, the reason why it's important, is the door of his heart. He was my father. It didn't matter what I did in my life. I was his son, and that was enough. That his love was unconditional. And that part of unconditional acceptance and love, that was a powerful part. There was no strings attached, no demands, nothing was required of me to have access to his heart. And that just opens up a huge amount of insight into meditation, to say, this moment, body, mind, the door of my heart is open to you, even though you're just such a stupid mind. You've slept most of the time and you're not sleeping. You just pretend to be meditating and thinking fantasies, or thinking just, you know, what you're going to have for lunch and how you can kill your wife, or how you're going to do something else. Oh, I don't care. But to be able to open your heart to all of that with unconditional acceptance to you, yourself. Self-love. What on earth does that mean? Don't try and improve yourself before you give yourself self-love. If you try and improve yourself first of all, number one, you will never improve yourself. You will die first. And number two, if you're trying to improve yourself, that's not self-love, that's self-hate. You may be, you know, reasonable, a judgment, you're not good enough, but that judgment, seen by itself, is just negative hate. It's just not being at peace with yourself, thinking that you have to improve to belong, to be worthy. You're demeaning and diminishing and giving yourself no value. That's one of the reasons why those Emperor Three Questions, giving value to this moment, giving value to whatever's in front of you, caring for it. Open the door of your heart to this moment. Or, I said, oh, well, I'll get rid of the ache first of all. I'll ask forgiveness for all those terrible things I've done first of all, then I'll love myself. Get rid of all my problems and difficulties, pay off all my debts, karmic and otherwise, then I love myself. Do it now. The door of my heart's open to me right now. That's a very difficult thing for people to do, even ordinary people. So that's one thing which you can try in this retreat, once you think you're up to that standard of courage. So go in your room, sit down, and with every piece of sincerity you can muster, to say, me, this person who bears my name, this being who I can never escape from, who I wake up with every morning, go to bed with every night, this person called me. With all your history, all the stupid things you've done, all the wonderful things you've done, I've done so many stupid things in my life. You know, one of the things I did in my life, when I was 10 years of age, with one of my friends, I still remember his name, Christopher Nightingale, we made a bomb. We did. And it exploded, boom. And it was in the local park. So I was a nascent terrorist, only became a monk. I was only 10 years of age, just playing around with my friend. My main part of that was supplying the tin can. And my friend, he was one of these bespectacled chemical wizards. So together, we put this thing in the park. It was only a small can, but it made a loud noise. Wow, that was, we felt really great, you know, it worked. Until we got caught. They were in big trouble. But anyway, so that was nice and peaceful and monk-to-be Ajahn Brahm making bombs as a kid. Always wonderful. So anyway, but sometimes over these things which you did in your life, you know, the funny things and just the, you know, the big mistakes, you sit down there and you say, me, whatever I've done in my life, and just, you don't deny anything, but you don't just focus on one thing, just a whole thing. The door of my heart's open to me. I forgive. And what you do, the story which I told, I never realized it was going to go so far, is that sometimes, in order to visualize this and make this little insight practice of unconditional love to oneself sort of practical, I imagined just a little heart in your chest. Now, I don't know if you have seen the real hearts, if you've been at all interested in anatomy, but the real heart is really ugly. It's got arteries here and tubes there and ventricles and goodness knows what else. It's not a sort of thing which, you know, obviously it works, functional, but it's not like a work of art. But so instead you see the little hearts you have on the playing cards on the Valentine's Day. So those are the ones to imagine right here in your chest. I know it's to the left side somewhere, but in the middle makes it much easier. So this is like a little bit of allowances for insight to happen. Insight license. So then you imagine this pair of doors in the middle of your heart. Just like the ones behind me here, or the ones over there, double doors. And you imagine just opening those doors of your heart. And inside is a part of me which I was proud of. The part of me which pleased my mother when I passed my exams. Not the part of me which gave her the birthday present which I was so surprised I never got punished for. You know, one day, it's like, these memories keep coming up. One day, I must have been about 7 or 8 years of age, somewhere around that time, you know, that's a cute little kid. Maybe on the outside. But it was her birthday present, so what can I get for my mum for her birthday? And in those days, there was a food fad of jellied eels and mashed potatoes. And so a shop had opened not far from where I lived, which sold jellied eels and mashed potatoes. So I went to the shop, a nice innocent kid, and saved up some money, and I brought an eel, a live one. And I already had everything else ready, a little shoebox, which I put the eel in, and this birthday wrapping paper, the most expensive I could possibly find. And I really put as much as a 6 or 7 year old kid, 8 year old kid could do, to wrap it up really carefully, you know, with the sticky tape so it didn't come apart, and a nice ribbon, and tied a bow on it, and a little greetings card. Happy birthday, Mummy, from your son, Peter. And I did all of that. The hardest part was keeping the straight face when I gave it to my mum. Well, I pulled it off. I really did, because I gave them the present to my mother. And she thought, can you imagine that? Any mothers here, your kid gives you a nice little gift like that. And they did it all by themselves. And yeah, it may not be the sort of the best bow in the world, but my kid did that for me. All that effort and all that kindness. Oh, my mother was almost in tears. And she went, oh, thank you, darling. She opened it up and took the paper off. And as she, this I will never forget, as she opened up the lid, the eel, almost as if it was trained, reared up in front of her. Ah! She screamed. And I was smart enough to have, these days I've got a name for it, your exit strategy. I knew exactly where I was going to run and hide to for a couple of hours until the heat went down. So that's what a naughty kid I was. I'm sure that some of you have done worse things like that or stupid things like that in your life thinking. But anyway, so you open the door of your heart. And the nice parts of you, that part of me, you know, which I didn't really like, would you do that for your poor mum too? For, you know, that I imagine was little people, that little Peter who was so naughty gave his mother an eel for her birthday. Out there somewhere, in the cold, outside. The sorts of things you're embarrassed about. the sorts of things which you wish you hadn't have done. The acts of body, speech or mind which, if you had your time again, if you go back into the past, you do it differently. Because it really hurts somebody or hurt yourself. And those little parts of you are outside, in the cold, rejected. The dark parts of you, which you always have, those dark parts. And the next thing you do is you imagine a ladder coming down from up here in your heart down to the ground. And all those parts of you you're ashamed of, the parts which you wish you hadn't have done, the parts which you feel guilty about, the parts which you're really still hurting, maybe you haven't even acknowledged all of those little beings which had your name so many years ago, all down there, outside, and you invite them up. Come up. That was me, I was a naughty little boy. I was stupid, I did the wrong thing. Come up. And as they, each one of them come up, at the top of the stairs, you embrace, say, I'll never keep you out of my heart ever again. You're who I am, you're my history. The naughty boy who sort of made a bomb. The boy who, what else did I do? See little things which you did, which afterwards, you know, you feel bad about. What are those yous you bring up? You embrace, they're part of who you are. Come in. You're saying the door of my heart is open to me, all of me. The stupid ones, the ones who made mistakes, you can all come in. So you never try to get rid of your history, even the painful part. Instead you invite it in and you care for it. It's one of those little sayings, that how do you really let go of the very hard parts of the past or the very fearful parts of your future? Add kindness first of all. You soften it, give it kindness, and then you can bring it in. But you never try to get rid of things. Embrace it, and then it's not a problem anymore. So I've taught that many times about people doing that, and it's a wonderful thing to do. People have addictions, drugs, pornography, alcohol, whatever those addictions are. Sometimes, why? What are you trying to escape from? Because there's something inside of you feel guilty about, you don't like about yourself. And this is what we do, we allow ourselves to come in. All of us. So anyway, I never thought that would go to such an extreme of people have been really traumatized, but that's what they've been doing. Because when I went to this assets group, I said, well, you know, why did you invite me this time? I said, because we want you to see this. It was like even on the board, opening the door of your heart. And some of these people who had been multiple rape just because they're on the wrong side of politics, or because their father was, or something, in these dungeons and dark places of the world. People have been beaten until they would have probably preferred to death than to survive. But they made it through physically. And then, when it's their time to do this, when they feel safe, you can never push anything in life, any sort of practice of meditation, insight, reconciliation, force just makes it worse. You just have to, when it's ready, and then you just do this little visualization, sitting down, closing your eyes, the Valentine's Day heart on your chest, open the two doors, seeing that those little girls who are so brutalized outside. It's amazing, not only are you afraid of them, but you're ashamed of them. No, you didn't do anything wrong, but you're ashamed that that was you. Afraid, terrorized, wanting, if you had a magic wand to make it all disappear, you would wave that wand so it goes and doesn't torture you ever again. But you can't do that. Instead, you put down that ladder and invite them in. And you visualize this little girl who was so badly treated, shaking, needing all your encouragement. Come up. I know how much you hurt, but you're part of me. You're who I am. Come in. And just all the encouragement to actually walk up those stairs and be invited into your house. The door of my house will always be open to you. My history, my past. No matter what has ever happened, I will never be ashamed of you. I'll never be afraid of you. And the hugging, the embracing as they come in. And it works. Instead of trying to forget the past, we embrace it with kindness, and then it's not a big problem anymore. The person comes in and they're at ease, at peace. Emotionally, now they're free. So that's a wonderful thing. That's an example of what insight is. It works in places where you would never expect it to. You know, on freeing a person from psychological torture, which, you know, sometimes you can't see that in another person. Physically, they're healthy, they're strong, they're doing well, but just the physical part is there to be seen, but the emotional part is just so poor and so much suffering. It's one of the reasons why that people commit suicide. And sometimes the ones who commit suicide, you look at them and they're sort of healthy, they're strong, they're young, but you can only see their outside. So what's happening inside of them, sometimes they keep so well hidden. So anyway, that's an important part of health, and being able to be compassionate enough to do that for yourself and teach it to others is a wonderful thing to be able to do. And of course, that's just with the emotional part, the physical part as well. I don't know how many times that I think I already mentioned a little bit about how the insight into your body and letting your body be, instead of worrying about it so much. And in other words, just you can get to know your body. Yeah, amazing thing to say, isn't it? You've been living with your body for such a long time, but do you really know it? And one of those little insights of kindness is that, I think I've already mentioned this to a few people on the interviews, that sometimes, you know, even I meditate, go to bed at night, have a good sleep, but for no reason at all, sometimes I feel tired. I'm really physically tired. What are you feeling tired about? You know, you haven't really worked hard today, you had a good sleep. Why do you feel physically exhausted? And sometimes the reason is that I don't know. But what I do know is that my body has got some reason to ask me to go to sleep. And so I trust my body. The insight is that there's too many things in this body I will never get to know, but I will trust it. So those times, if it's at all possible, I've headed to my room, laid down, and I know it's the right thing. It's not indulgence, it's not laziness, because as soon as my head hits the pillow, I'm out. And I have a really deep sleep for about 45 minutes or an hour, and when you wake up, you feel so good. And usually I'll have a shower, a cup of tea or something, or just a drink of water, and then I meditate. Whoa, that's always a great meditation. Why is that? Because a lot of the time there's so many bugs and viruses around. Because there's so many bugs and viruses around, especially look at me, I just travel around the world a lot. And whenever you travel around the world, you always have to pass through these airports. and airports, people from all over the world carrying international bugs and sharing them. And there's probably one of the most unhealthy places to go through airport terminals. But even though I go through airport terminals a lot, I never get terminal illness. Okay, you must have seen that coming. Come on. Terminal illness. But could you listen to your body? Your body's telling you, you know, just take 45 minutes off. And when you rest afterwards, you feel so good. And I can give my talks, meditate, whatever I need to do. And I try that so often, and I trust it these days. I never feel guilty. I just being lazy, Ajahn Brahm. Come on, do something. Go fight the fever. No way. I understand it, learn from it, and whew, much healthier. So even now, this is, I don't know how many days of the retreat, it's already gone, but even now, if you ever feel tired, just go to your room. Rest. This, and then, you know, it's only been for 45 minutes or an hour, and if you do really fall asleep, you got it right. And then you wake up afterwards, you feel so great. I used to try this when, as a solution, when on interviews, people come and say, I'm terrible meditation, I'm wasting my time here. For 3 or 4 days, I've gotten nowhere. It's just really a mess. I just try and meditate. I'm restless or fall asleep and go for a cup of tea. I've had so many cups of tea. Watching the trees grow, they're not grown at all since I've been here. Don't know what to do next. And that's what I tell them. I said, look, go to your room, lay down, have a sleep, wake up, juice or tea or something, and then shower, and then meditate. And I can't do that. That's indulgence. Go to your room, have a cup of tea, and then shower, and then meditate. Well, no, I can't. Go to your room. And because they trust me, they do that. And they come up afterwards. I don't know how many times people have said this. Thank you, Ajahn, that was the best meditation ever. Of course it is. Simply because you're letting go, you're working with your body. You're not controlling it. You're listening, you're being mindful, you're caring for this body. And you give this body a tiny bit of care, and this body will repay you with just so much cooperation. And so that is something in meditation which, you know, you've seen. That's what the Buddha did say in the middle way, avoiding extremes of things which tire the body. And thinking you're in such control that you can actually dominate your body, you can tell it when it's going to be sick. And you can't be sick on this retreat. You paid a lot of money for this. It's very rare to be able to come on a retreat like this to actually to get your name down, actually to be here. You can't waste a moment of this. That sort of attitude, of course, will just, I mean, you are wasting your time with that sort of attitude, but the kindness really works. So then you get to know your body. You get insight into how this body works. You may not be able to put it into words, but you certainly... That little thing I said about that lady from Adelaide who had chronic anxiety. How come no one knows? How come it's not taught so often? Every emotion you have is manifested on your body somewhere. Every emotion. So when you have an emotion, why don't we just learn how it affects our body? And not only does it show us how, you know, things like cancers come from, and other heart disease and stuff, because we're really tight and tense, and if you're mindful, you can start to feel these things happening. But also, how you can heal these things. The emotions in the mind are just so difficult to understand if you haven't done lots of meditation, but you know how they feel in your body, and that's why that little massage of your chest when you have anxiety. You know, and I don't know why people can't do this. Really massage it to the point that it really feels good. Sometimes people are afraid of feeling good. This can't be, you know, enjoying yourself, feeling good, massaging your body. What's that got to do with meditation? The insight comes pretty quickly that when I do that, my chest starts to feel really good. It's really nice. Now, any anxiety, you know, which caused that tension to begin with, also disappears. Anger. The anger. When you're angry, you only see the object of your anger, the person out there or the thing out there. You never actually see how it manifests in your body. When you feel how what anger is like in your body, oh, that's really painful. So it's quite easy just to relax the anger in the body. There, Ajahn Brahm. It's what people are like, you know. You really work hard giving them teachings and they do completely the opposite. So you have to teach the next time. Never mind, Ajahn Brahm. Even the Buddha had disciples who wouldn't listen to them. So when you're kind to yourself, it's amazing just how the problem just vanishes. And also, you're realizing this you can actually do yourself. It's almost like the self-help. The self-help movement, the self-improvement movement. Oh, I can't resist this little anecdote about the person who went to the big bookshop and asked the person on the counter there, where is the section on self-help? And the lady on the counter said, if I told you, it would defeat the purpose. That's obvious. Self-help. I think I'm beyond help. So anyway, so when you realize, you can actually take a bit of control, if you like, not control, you've got your own power, you don't have to depend upon others, you know how to look after yourself. And this, if you're really sick, obviously you call an ambulance and stuff, but then, just in the meantime, you just have a great idea of how to relax your own body and ease some of the symptoms of life. And even that little insight I said yesterday, last night, one of the reasons I keep talking about these things, about the pushing the wheelbarrow is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part. And wow, that saves so much problems. You're doing an exam, you're having a biopsy, you're having your leg amputated, I don't know what. Thinking about it is the hard part. Really is. Oh, what am I going to do? I don't know how I'm going to manage with one leg. But thinking about it is the hard part. Doing it in life, you find it's not that hard at all. Things which you thought were impossible will cause a lot of problems. It's the thoughts which cause the suffering. And I think you all know that, but we forget it. And these are insights which really help our life. And other insights, making decisions. Are you good at making decisions? Making decisions. This is all about the future. Should I go left or should I go right when I go through the gate? And sometimes people say, well, if I turn left, this is what will happen, and this is what will happen, and if I turn right, then this is what will happen, and that's what will happen. We spend so much time and energy worrying about whether we should turn left or whether we should turn right that we get so frustrated. We neither don't make a decision where we have to. We're just so tired. So instead of worrying about whether you should turn left, whether you should turn right, just do it. Don't think about it. Say turn left. And then save all your energy, which you usually waste on worrying. And once you have turned left, make it work. Preserve your energy for after you've made the decision, not before. It's a nice little insight like that. So sometimes I try and get as much information as possible, then just make a decision. And then I make it work. Starting a nun's monastery. Made the decision. instead of wondering, oh my goodness, what will happen if I get kicked out of my monastery, and then how can I get enough funds to look after all these nuns? Because they're not just ordaining them, you know, you've got to train them, make sure they're fine, make sure they're competent in teaching all sorts of things like the chanting and the kangaroo walking meditation. And they do such a lovely job on that. So that's part of my job. So instead of thinking, oh, shouldn't I, what will I do? No, I just do it and then make the decision and then save all your energy to after you've made the decision. Because otherwise you make a decision and you've got no energy left to make it work. So those are insights into just the world. Those are the insights into, and please don't ask me, where are the two bad bricks? I know that many of you have gone to see my cave already, and I mentioned I think I'm the only person in the world whose bedroom is a tourist attraction. And it really is my bedroom. If I wasn't here today, I'd be in there right now, just meditating or, you know, just sleeping when it's the time to sleep. That's really where I live. Spend a lot of time in there. And anyway, now, when you go over there and you sort of see these things and you get inspired, just how wonderful is simplicity? You get the insight into the less you have, the more freedom you have. So why is it in this world we just have so much stuff in our rooms? How much do you need? You can always let go a bit more, and let go a bit more, and let go a bit more. Even as the extreme case was this gentleman came to our centre in Nolomar. He's a gentleman. I thought only females had this addiction, but apparently that was my misogynist, sexist, discriminatory mind at work again. And he said, "Oh, would you like a new, was it LCD widescreen TV, about 3 foot wide or something?" I said, no, thank you, we don't have TVs in the monastery. Or maybe use it as a monitor in your library. He said, no, we don't need it. He said, it's a new one. I said, a new one? Well, why did you buy it? He said, because it was on sale. The only reason he brought it, not because he needed it, or he had a place to put it, he just bought it because it was on sale, that was all. I can't get my head around that. You know, it's one of those other things which is blocked for me. I just don't. Anyway, so he had to find another place. Well, I don't know where he put it. Anyway, but we didn't have it. So anyway, back to the insights into just living simply. And the two bad bricks in the world, I lost them for years. Apparently they're down in the monk's toilet block, so you can't go to visit there. You can visit my bedroom because I'm not always there, but there's always monks in the toilet block, so don't go down there with your cameras looking for the two bad bricks in the wall. You know, that was a simple insight. Why was it that, you know, when I made two mistakes, that's all I ever saw for 3 months? It's weird, isn't it? You know, 998, well, actually, that wasn't the number, probably more like 1,500 good bricks and about 2 bad bricks, crooked bricks. But why? Why did I always think about my mistakes? Why did I focus on those mistakes so much that I woke up, you know, in nightmares and, what have I done? And I'm thinking to blow up the wall to start again. But, you know, Ajahn Chakra wouldn't let me. And until someone pointed out my stupidity, yeah, there's 2 bad bricks, we can see those, but we can see the 998 good bricks. And that was the first time in 3 months I could physically see anything except my mistakes. Every time I passed that wall, every time I thought of it, my eyes would just be drawn to my mistakes. It's a fault-finding mind. And so often, that's been conditioned into us. Look at your faults, says your mum. You haven't cleaned behind your ears. You can grow potatoes behind there, she said. That's why you see stuff ever. Did your kid mama say that? Yeah, they'll say. And all those faults, you know, always seen. And so I became like a fault finder, looking at sort of faults in life, the faults in jhana growth, the faults in the cooking, the faults in everything. And I could never actually see the what was to the left, the right, above and below, all the things which I thought were wrong in life and in fault and wrong in me. And then when you saw that, you realised, wow, what a wonderful teaching, what a great insight that was. And to that day, I never wanted to overcome faults. Just want to see what's to the left and the right, above and below. Because the faults, as that builder said, and when I went to teach this in the cancer group, he said, all bricklayers make mistakes. In the building industry, we call those features, and we charge our clients an extra couple of $1,000 for them, for the mistakes. And I thought, what a beautiful ending of that story it was. What I thought were faults were actually features. Now, when I passed you last night and a few of you were looking at the sunset and taking photographs, you know, there was a bit of cloud. It could have been smoke from fires, I'm not sure. But there was a bit of cloud on the horizon. There was imperfections in the sky which actually allowed the oranges and the crimsons to be spread across the sky. If there was no clouds, you wouldn't have such gorgeous sunsets. Imperfections are needed to make the most beautiful sunsets here. Bad bricks are necessary in the wall to really appreciate that these walls were not built by robots, built by humans. This is actually the insights, which means we don't need to cure our husband. We love him as he is. He married you, you married him. You have your faults as well. You both got lots of faults, which is always why you're a match. You don't think that at the time, but come on. So, little by little, that we learn how to make peace with Yuzi's insights. And of course, those insights get even deeper into the nature of our very mind. Why are we always so fault-finding? Why is one sort of trying to improve ourselves? Well, aren't you good enough already? Aren't you? If you make peace, you're contented and easily satisfied, not proud and demanding in nature. Imagine that. Imagine being at peace with yourself. Not trying to improve yourself. You sit here, close your eyes. I don't try to improve myself. I'm not trying to get anywhere. Just being here. Letting go. Stopping trying to get anywhere. Which brings me up to the one of my favorite insight stories, also about how to be enlightened. The donkey and the carrot. I thought insight, I should actually say that story because that's one of the best. But I've left it to the very end. Never mind. The donkey and the carrot. Many of you have heard this story from me before. It is a traditional Ajahn Brahma. I'm sure someone will take it on for some sort of therapy course and make it, they have copyright, so I won't be able to say it anymore. Unless I pay them a fee, even though it came from me, I invented this. So, the donkey and the carrots. A donkey is the most stubborn animal in the world. That's why in English they have the phrase, as stubborn as a donkey. But donkeys are very strong. And sometimes they use them to pull carts, donkey carts. But the trouble is, how can you get the donkey started to pull the cart? You can get a stick and beat that poor donkey. The donkey doesn't move. That's how stubborn it is. Just like husbands. Really stubborn. Just like wives. Really stubborn. So you don't use sticks to beat anybody. Instead, you tie the stick to the back of the donkey's neck. So the front of the stick is 2 foot in front of the donkey's head. On the end of the stick, you put the string. On the end of the string, you put a carrot. But, of course, if this was in Asia, if it was in Singapore, Malaysia, you'd put a piece of durian. Durian? No, not durian. What else would you put? Noodles. You put a bowl of noodles. Okay, a bowl of noodles. Is that a couple of hours to lunch? No, pack of noodles. Okay, so you put a pack of noodles on the end of this stick, and the Singaporean donkey sees those noodles, and of course the donkey goes towards the noodles and pulls the cart at the same time. And as it goes towards the bag of noodles, the stick moves, the string moves, and so do the noodles move. It doesn't matter how fast a donkey runs after those noodles, she never gets them. You can see them. If they're already caught, you can smell them. You can see the steam coming off of them. But you can't actually reach them. Because every time you go towards them, they move away from you. And that was such a beautiful insight of life. All those things which we look for in life. You know, if you're a musician, the masterpiece, you know, the perfect performance, the perfect game. You know, if you're a sports coach, just the perfect moment. If you're a writer, that time when just the poem just comes out just almost perfectly. The perfect relationship, the perfect evening, the perfect whatever it is you want in life. Sometimes you can see it. Financial security, happiness, you almost see it. You go towards it and it moves away from you. Nimittas, jhanas, enlightenment. You run after it and it goes away from you. Now the difference between this donkey and ordinary donkeys. This donkey has read Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, my book about meditation, where this story I think is listed there. This donkey has been to meditation retreats somewhere, so it knows how to catch the carrot. Or the bag of noodles. It's so easy once you figure it out. That's what happens with insight. In insight, you think, how come I didn't see that before? But once you see it, it's obvious. So, the donkey has been running after that bag of noodles for such a long time. But now, it stops. Let's go. Renounces. Just is sitting here, not doing anything in the whole world. Just whatever happens is fine by me. Opening the door of your heart, letting things go. Renouncing. What happens to bag of noodles? It goes. Swings further away from you. Until it's further away than it's ever been before. 4 foot in front of your mouth. And then something happens. The bag of noodles stops. And it starts coming towards you. All of your happiness, your joy, perfection, peace, jhanas, they start coming towards you. You don't do anything, you just sit there and wait. Just a very peaceful donkey, just sitting here doing nothing, letting go, just being mindful, being kind, no effort, not doing, not chasing anything, just being here. And soon that noodles is right in its usual place, 2 foot in front of your mouth. But this time, it's actually coming towards you at high speed. And soon when it gets to the end of its trajectory, it's right in front of your mouth. And the last thing the donkey has to remember when the carrot or the bag of noodles swings right to its mouth is kindness, compassion, metta. It says to those pack of noodles, the door of my mouth is open to you. Come in. Have you ever seen donkeys? They've got these huge teeth. If you don't open the door of the mouth, they just bounce off. The enlightenment just bounces off your teeth and goes out again. You get so close, you miss it. So, okay, it's a funny story, but there's a lot of truth in that. It's a powerful story. Stop chasing things. Just sit here, content, easily satisfied, not proud, not demanding. Just sit here and wait. And all these great meditations, they will come to you. Unbelievable, but true. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay.